It's time for a healthy breakfast.
Which is the number one chocolate
drink. Two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderfully fresh.
That's a spicy
kind of like, you know, Western savior coming in to rescue the global South, right?
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
I'm Raj Patel from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs.
And I'm Tom Philpott from Mother Jones Magazine.
Today's secret ingredient is nutrition. Now, that's odd because nutrition is meant to be the opposite of secret. It's meant to be public and transparent and obvious. But it is odd, strange, and mysterious. And today's guest is going to explain to us why. Aya Hirata Kimura is an associate professor at the College of Social Sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And her research focuses on the intersection of techno-science and gender, particularly in the fields of food and environmental issues in Asia. Her 2013 book from Cornell University Press is called Hidden Hunger: Science, Gender, and the Politics of Smart Food. And we are very excited to have you on the show. So welcome, Aya.
Thank you for having me.
So look, should we just jump right in? Why ought we to be worried about nutrition? Surely nutrition is exactly what it is that's good for us.
Sure. I think my claim would be that we have to be worried about a particular kind of nutritional science sort of paradigm that is characterized as nutritionism. And this is not my term, but it's by Gregory Scrinius. I think he's at University of Melbourne. And he talks about how nutritionism really shapes the modern Western nutritional science in a way that is highly reductive, right? So that then nutritionism really sees food only as a vehicle for carrying certain kinds of nutrients and strip off other kinds of important dynamics such as cultural, political, economic. So that, I think, is highly consequential for us to notice that that's how we are increasingly viewing food as sort of just a vehicle, just a delivery mechanism of certain nutrients.
So, but isn't that what nutrition is? Sure, you can have other things. And obviously, I'm being a little tendentious here, but let me go with this. If food is anything more than a delivery vehicle, then it's something else. I mean, obviously, food has its cultural dimension and it has its historical bits and pieces. But at the end of the day, as far as human health is concerned, what's wrong with thinking that food is just a delivery vehicle for nutrients?
Right. So in the book, I talk about sort of the tangible example of how nutritionism operates in the global South. And the example that I talk about is biofortification and fortification, right? And maybe the example that I can talk about is golden rice, which is an example of biofortification. And that is the genetically modified crops to have higher content of beta carotene, then that could be turned into vitamin A. So it's a strategy to address vitamin A deficiency in the global South, and it's being sort of marketed as such. But if we operate within the paradigm of nutritionism, then the fact that golden rice is great because it carries this nutrient, the beta carotene, the vitamin A. And it's eaten by many population in the Asian countries, et cetera, because we see, nutrition sees rice or any crop for that matter as just a vehicle. However, when I was interviewing in Indonesia, rice has such an important sort of cultural meaning, political meaning, that people were like, we were not sure whether this is the right crop to be tinkling with. Right, rice, for example, in Bali, is a product, a crop that's it's thought to be made cultivated not only by human, but in collaboration with God. Right, in Java, it's intricately tied with ethnic identity. So, but nutritionism just sees rice as just a vehicle, and so I think because of such reductive conceptualization, it ultimately, I think, fails to deliver the nutrients if it meets the resistance because of the cultural, political, and economic reasons.
Now, one thing that comes to mind is that these sort of international development agencies have identified a problem, that there is this micronutrient deficiency, this deficiency in vitamin A. And what you just described is sort of this nutritionist approach. Let's slap it onto this vehicle that's already going into people's bodies, i.e. rice, and that will solve the problem. What would be a way to address the deficiency that took the cultural aspect into account that you're talking about? What's an alternative way besides golden rice to address that problem?
Right. So micronutrient deficiency is often sort of nicknamed as hidden hunger, and that's the title of my book. Was the topic that I was really interested in because I felt that it's been sort of become the problem for the international nutrition community in such a reductive way that then it opened up opportunities for essentially the private sector to come up with different kinds of fortification and fortified products as the solution for the global poor. And part of my criticism has to do with this top-down orientation that we know your problem, right? You suffer from A and B, and we have the fix, So it's kind of like, Western savior coming in to rescue the global South, right? So I don't want to do that by suggesting that these ought to be the alternative solutions, right?
Right.
And so part of the critique is that it's not to say that I have the solution, but my critique has to do with how these supposed beneficiaries are not listened to in terms of how we resolve the broader issue of food insecurity in the global South. And this is really glaring in terms of how women are highlighted as the major victim of hidden hunger. If you think about vitamin A deficiency, particularly also iron deficiency anemia, women are oftentimes highlighted as the most vulnerable victim, right? So sure. But what I have found was that they are rhetorically highlighted and they are hyper-visible in the policy discourses, yet when they come to sort of do the policy programming, they're not at all being asked to participate in what do you need? Like, why is it that you can't feed your babies, nutritious food? Or why is it that you can't obtain, green leafy vegetables that's high in iron and vitamins? So I think my suggestion would not to be offer another kind of technical fixes to the problem of hidden hunger, but to think about the process of even defining the problem, right, mm-hmm. with the people, with the supposed beneficiary of these international nutrition projects.
I'm trying to formulate a question and get at something which maybe you can help me with, because what I am understanding is that there's this idea that nutritionism comes in to solve the problems of malnutrition with kids and women especially, but mm-hmm. then there's this sense that this traditional knowledge that women hold in feeding their families is not sufficient to feed their families anymore, and so what's lost is the big business, the corporations that are coming in that actually create that problem. But it seems to come into the idea of a feminist critique or a gendered perspective on this almost camps traditional knowledge with everything that is quote unquote past. So there's this idea like science is going to save us, nutritionism is going to save us, technology is going to save us, and in some ways women are outside of that conversation. So there's women as traditional, and they're not in the conversations about nutrition and health, and they're not really at the table with those conversations.
I think it might be a false dichotomy to draw the line between sort of women on the traditional side and then the modern science, and somehow they're at war with each other. I think, when I interviewed about 40 women in the urban slum areas in Indonesia, asking them about, their food situations and their experience of trying to feed their children. These are very impoverished women. And, you know, they did enjoy sort of talking about, you know, vitamins and, you know, nutrients and healthy growth and smart start, right? So, and then they did talk about, well, you know, I want to buy these products because the alternatives are, you know, worse. Like the porridges they might get off from the street vendor, they felt that some of them are not hygienic enough. And, you know, they might try to buy, to cook porridges and stuff like that. But they knew that because of their limited economic means, they couldn't add nutritious ingredients to it. So I think women do try to participate in Western science. They are curious. And but at the same time, I think the benefits that you can get from the Western nutritional science is highly class stratified, right? That particularly when these sort of the products that are being offered as superior are commercial products. And so on the one hand, they feel like they need to be operating within sort of this nutritionalized mode. And they are, you know, like us, right? Like when we go through the supermarket aisle, we sort of screen the food through this nutritionalized lens, so to speak. And so I think that is there as well. But at the same time, you know, I can try to buy like fortified food and say like, oh, you know, my kids will be smarter or something like that. But if you're highly impoverished, then it just really disempowers them because they feel really inadequate as a mother because they can't buy those superior and expertly engineered foods that has high, you know, iron, vitamin A, and other micronutrients.
I mean, I love how you're pointing out in that specific example that, in fact, women are making sort of scientific and rational choices around, you know, given limited ability to participate and limited information. I mean, they understand that actually the thing that's probably going to kill their kid is diarrhea that comes from poor hygiene, and that avoiding unhygienic products or, you know, products that require you to use contaminated water is probably the smart thing to do, as well as understanding that you want your kid to be smarter and want to have whatever it is added into industrially processed food. But I one of the other insights that I really enjoyed in your book is how this starts. There's this sort of interesting moment in the 1990s where all of a sudden nutritional deficiencies in the global south become the project of international development, because, you know, it's not always been the case that hidden hunger is the main agenda item for combating world hunger. I mean, when I was growing up, the problem used to be just an absence of food. But since then, something has shifted. And I wonder if you could talk us a little bit through how it is that either the women that you were talking about or the world in general has become so subject to nutritionism, some of the forces behind that.
Sure. But just to clarify that the nutrition has been on the agenda for development agencies, right, for a long time before 1990s, and you know, global malnutrition and hunger in the developing countries have been, I think, emblematic issue to be tackled by sort of benevolent, you know, colonizer or the colonial countries, or then, you know, post-war and independence international development agencies. And the 1950s, protein was the focal point, and, you know, people were talking about protein deficiency. 80s was vitamin A, but 1990s then was grouped together as micronutrients. So it's not that 1990s was the first time that international development agencies started to get excited about the nutrients, but the way that they try to intervene in the problem is very peculiar, and I think it reflects the largest neoliberal policies, right, and the discourses in international development. That is to say that when we talk about hidden hunger or micronutrient deficiencies, that oftentimes proposed solutions are, like I said, biofortification and fortification. And these things could be presented as a very good example of a celebrated idea of public-private partnership, right? And the idea of public-private partnership is that, you know, government should have a smaller role and market has the more efficient way of intervening and providing services and goods. And so, like the example of fortified biscuits or cookies and fortified instant noodles that became the part of the food aid in Global South, these are coordinated by international aid agencies or the national governments, but products themselves are manufactured by, packaged by the transnational corporations. So I think the availability of the solutions in a sort of easy manner, relatively easy manner, in the form of fortification, and how that fits well in this larger trend that emphasizes private-public partnership and the growing role of the private sector or the market, I think was behind the increasing salience of hidden hunger or micronutrient deficiency in the 1990s. And another thing is, if we look at who has sponsored these micronutrient deficiency programs in international development, one of the most powerful actors has been World Bank. And it's interesting to think about why World Bank is pushing for this agenda, right? And from the vantage point of the bank, nutrition used to be seen as the cost to development. But around 1990s, they started to reframe nutrients as investment for the purpose of international national development, right? And I think that reframing took place partly because they had been critiqued severely for their SAP, structural adjustment programs, in the 1980s that led to significant public health costs, right? So the SAP is when the Global South was suffering from the debt crisis. What happened was, you know, they were going to be bailed out by these multilateral lending institutions, but they imposed significant conditionalities. So those are structural adjustment programs that oftentimes entail trade liberalization, privatization of national industries, but also a retrenchment in terms of social services. And these were, again, in line with the neoliberal logic that has been exposed by the World Bank. But then, you know, it really became clear that SAP had significant human costs. And, you know, the criticism came not only from sort of the NGO type, but it came even from the medical experts. I think there was an article in Lancet that critiqued the health costs, you know, human costs of SAP. I think UNICEF also critiqued World Bank for imposing the significant cuts in healthcare and so on. So in order to respond to that, I think World Bank had to engage, right, with health and nutrition. And so, and then to do that, they reframed nutrition as investment that would have tangible economic benefits. And for that, I think hidden hunger really fit nicely as well. So for those reasons, I think it was the 1990s that hidden hunger became the focal point for international development.
Okay, so in that sort of framework, what the fortification programs do is that they sort of clean up the messes of cuts in healthcare, cuts in food aid, cuts in all these programs that were brought through with the programs that the IMF and the World Bank were imposing. So it's a way of sort of cleaning up the messes.
Right. And then you can, I think, also there's another trend in international development that really points to the need for sort of accountability politics, right? And so if you're thinking about hidden hunger, there are different strategies to address than fortification. And before the rise of fortification in the 1990s, some agencies did, for example, like home gardening or community gardening, right? To that would then hopefully will diversify the diets of the people, then also to address the issue of hidden hunger in the communities. But now, if you're sort of bound by this accountability mandate, then it's easier with the fortification because you can say, well, we delivered how many milligrams or whatever to how many children in this community, right? Whereas if you're just doing, you know, trying to do like carrots and spinach and, you know, how many grams are, you know, produced and how many are eaten by actually by the, you know, the recipients, it's much more, it's much messier, right? And so that also was a part of it.
I wonder if you would talk a little bit about baby food. You did a great paper some years back on the sort of rise of baby food in Indonesia. And I wonder if you could just start by talking about the construction of baby food as a thing that people needed to buy.
Yeah, so that then also is kind of related to this focus on micronutrient deficiencies. So around the same time in the 1990s, in tandem with this global attention to hidden hunger, researchers started to look at nutritional components of complementary food that is fed along with breast milk. And they found that actually many traditional or homemade baby food were substandard in terms of suboptimal in terms of the micronutrient contents. And so the idea came to be that maybe we should also think about the option of industrially made commercial fortified baby food as necessary component of the diets in and for the babies in the global south. And in the case of Indonesia, the leading nutritional experts called for what they said a new paradigm of baby food, where, you know, before it was thought that the traditional one is okay and sufficient, but now we are realizing that it's not. And so that's sort of the scientific and expert and policy discourse, right? And alongside with that, there is obviously international formula or baby food makers operating in the global south. And in the case of Indonesia, the market of baby food is dominated by multinational corporations, particularly Nestle and Sari Husada, which is the Indonesian branch of Nutricia that's now, I think, owned by Danone. And there are also others like, you know, Japanese Morinaga, Abbott, Wythe, and a couple of others. So this is a very much a growing market because Indonesian population is relatively young, high fertility rates, that means there are a lot of babies to be fed. And so alongside this policy and expert discourse that is increasingly emphasizing the importance of micronutrients, the corporate marketing of baby food is emphasizing the specific micronutrients and specific health health benefits of those nutrients. So I analyzed a Indonesian parenting magazine and how they had lots of advertisements for these baby food and formula, and found that the messaging has really shifted from the earlier 90s, 80s, and 70s advertisement. Like earlier advertisements really said, like, you know, if you feed this food to your baby, then your baby will gain weight more, or, you know, will be taller or bigger, or, you know, the growth, just general growth was emphasized before. Whereas contemporary advertisement really linked a particular vitamin and mineral to a particular health benefits, right? So you have, you know, DHA, and it's linked to brain growth. You have pre-vitamin, prebio or something like that, and you have, you know, higher resilience or something like that. So the overall message was that these products are expertly sort of engineered to have specific micronutrients that then would have specific these health benefits. And another thing that I talk about is to look at how these messages are targeted. And obviously, most of them are targeted at women, the mothers. And the overall message then is that if you're, you know, good mother, you know, you don't want to make compromise, you have to buy these products to ensure the smart growth of your babies and children.
But is that really anything new, or is this just another way of conveying that we're going to tell you what's good for you and we're going to give it to you in this pill form or in this fortified food form? Do you
right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, specifically about baby food and formula. I mean, if maybe like you recall that since the 60s, there was a global social mobilization against formula industry, right? So in the 60s, it came to a lot of people realize that the babies in the Global South are dying because they are fed with formula, because the formula industry aggressively marketed those products when, in fact, communities didn't have the proper infrastructure, such as access to clean water and the ability to sanitize a bottle. So that discourse then frame the baby food industry as a sort of the liability in terms of public health. What is different right now is that the market, the private sector, has been sort of recast as a savior of the baby because these are the guys who can provide these properly fortified products that have micronutrients that are missing from the homemade baby food. So that, I think, discursive change is huge because the private industry can now say that we are partnering, we are the partner for public health, and we are the partner for improving the food security situation in the Global South, whereas before they were condemned as essentially provide, exacerbating the food insecurity and malnutrition in the Global South.
Really quick, too, before we continue, you've used this term neoliberal logic. Can you just describe how you're using that phrase?
Sure. So the neoliberalism is the school of thought in economics, right? And that really has advocated for the smaller role of government, the larger role for the market or the private sector, with the thought that the private sector is much more efficient in the provision of goods and services. So when I say neoliberal logic, that I think I tend to mean those initiatives that tends to advocate for the bigger role of the private sector and the smaller role for the public sector.
So is an example, yeah. Well, I'm thinking of a sort of specific example to follow up with the baby formula issue, mm-hmm. because Nestle has always maintained that the problem wasn't that its formula was in any way bad, although the marketing push towards baby formula away from breastfeeding is obviously a problem. But for Nestle, they were saying, well, the problem is the water. And is another difference between then and now the sort of giving up on municipal water supplies, and instead the private sector can come in and say, here's some baby milk formula, and we can also sell you bottled water. So the mm-hmm. privatization of water at the same time as the continuation of providing this baby milk powder ends up being the sort of the perfect match, because in the 70s, no one thought to bottled water because that would have been preposterous. Whereas mm-hmm. now that's, that's how we roll. And so I wonder whether you notice when you're in Indonesia that actually bottled water was part of the package.
No, I don't think I noticed that, but that's an excellent point to think about the broader trend of privatization of water rather than claiming that water is human rights.
Hmm. No, I wonder if we can talk a little bit more about this thing that you mentioned earlier on about how women are both required to be victims, but are also and required to be feeling fairly inadequate, and are required to to learn from their betters, but not allowed to say anything or not allowed to sort of feature in international discourse. Because when today we hear about Coke going into different parts of the world and empowering women. I imagine if we had a representative from some large multinational here, they would point to a pet project or two in which women were being empowered to be able to be small business owners, to be, in fact, the last mile deliverers of nutrition to their communities. How do you respond to that?
Right. I think oftentimes women are rhetorically highlighted and become hyper-visible as from the very essentialized framework. And so I don't know about Coca-Cola and going to using women as a deliverer of the nutrients. But what I've found in my work on hidden hunger is that they are presented as the victim, and that the Hidden Hunger projects like Fortified Food are targeted at, say, women of reproductive age. Therefore, international agencies tend to frame Hidden Hunger projects or fortification projects as sort of pro-women projects, right? Sort of feminist projects in international development. And the 1990 was a sort of the timing that is around that age where the concept of gender mainstreaming became central. And so I think a lot of international agencies saw that Hidden Hunger projects as in line with this gender mainstreaming. However, I think the discourse that tends to say, oh, these are pro-women projects, I think obfuscates the fact that sex as a sort of, you know, right, vector of power doesn't operate in isolation. That one of the most fundamental concepts in feminist studies is intersectionality, right? That, you know, sex intersects with, race, ethnicity, class, citizenship status, and maybe able-bodied and disabled bodies. So all of these parameters really differentially positions women. So women in Indonesia who are rich are completely fine, right? And so what does that mean to say women, this is a pro-women? Like, what kind of women are we talking about, right? And so that's sort of the loss of intersectionality, I think, is one problem that we have to be very careful of. And second is that when we say, oh, you know, these are, you know, for women, and women are likely to be victim, women are likely to be vulnerable to, say, disaster and disorder and, you know, diseases, that kind of biological argument, I think, really helps to depoliticize the problem, like I said, because the problem then is, you know, just reduced to that, you know, those reproductive functions of women that, say, you know, anemia, women are more likely to be anemic because they menstruate, they, you know, become pregnant, and they give birth to children. So that kind of biologizing argument really recasts the problem as in sort of in nature, natural, and then the policymakers and governments do not have to talk about the lack of healthcare, like sanitation, public infrastructure, or just the larger issue of poverty and stratification. So I think these two problems, I think, is really important when we think about, okay, when we say women, you know, where, what are we talking about? You know, what are we obfuscating by just making it a women's sort of sex-based issue rather than political issue?
But, I mean, won't the industry just come back to you and say, look, that may be all well and good, but surely we, Coke, Pepsi, Nestle, whoever it is, are coming forward with a solution here. In fact, the person around here who's anti-woman is you, because you're not coming up with anything. And this gets us back, I think, to the original point that you were making, that actually it's women's voices who are being that are actually being sidelined, and you don't want to step into that space of being able to offer a solution. But I'm wondering then, what solutions have you heard to this? I mean, how do we get ourselves out of this mess?
So besides asking for more participation in the decision making by women and asking them to define the problem for themselves.
Well, I mean, it seems like the terms of the problem are being set by, as you say, these public-private partnerships. And so if the context is public-private partnerships, most of the decision has been made once the partnership is undertaken. It seems to me that once a government has decided that the terms on which public-private partnerships happen, and once it's sort of in the common discourse that clearly nutrients are important for children, and anyone who gets between a child and their nutrients is an enemy of the people, then mm-hmm. you're in a sort of rhetorical game that you can't win. So what do you do about that? I mean, it is a big question. It's unfair to ask you to answer it, but I'm going to be unfair and ask you to answer it anyway. I'm wondering if you've heard of or seen strategies out of this, you know, this nutritionist cul-de-sac.
Right. So at the end of the book, I mean, like, I knew that this kind of questions would be coming, right? In a sense, like, what then is your solution alternative? And you know, like I said, I'm very much hesitant to say that this is the solution that would fit to any communities in, say, Indonesia or, you know, even the Global South, because that's exactly what I'm critiquing. And so I point to several examples of social movements, right? And particularly the food sovereignty movement. And I think they are really pushing the boundary in terms of how we address food security. And I think the global international development community has tended to frame it as the lack of food or lack of nutrients, very reductive and amenable to technical solutions. But what food sovereignty movement, I think, is really pushing for is the ability for the community themselves to define the problem itself, right? So once we define the problem of food security as the lack of nutrient, then the additional nutrients in the form of whatever would be the solution. But why don't, so the way that the problem itself is defined is going to define, is going to shape the solution. So the problem definition is highly critical and consequential. So can we let the communities decide to do that, right? And have them decide what the problem is, then that then subsequently shape the interventions. I think that would be the way that I would like to see the world move forward.
And, you know, along those same lines, how are women in Indonesia responding to this, to being cast in this area where they really don't know, you know, the best way to feed their children, or that they are somehow biologically predispositioned to certain things, and when they must know that that's not the case, you know, that they're being cast in this light? And how do they respond to that, you know, from all across the class structure, I guess?
Right. And then I think we need to point out that there is no sort of generic Indonesian women, right? It's stratified by ethnicity, citizenship status, particularly also by class. I mean, there were women, for example, they are very much advocating for breastfeeding and fighting the baby food industry, along with the, I think, transnational movement, such as IFAN International, what's that term?
Baby Milk Action Formula.
Yeah, Breast Milk Action Network. Another example is the food sovereignty movement in Indonesia as well, that is pretty much based on the peasant organization. There is a labor activism as well. You know, when I was talking about women's vulnerability and how economy is part, ought to be the part of it, and poverty ought to be the part of the discussion, I think we need to realize that the Indonesian female workers are at the bottom of the regional labor hierarchy, and their wage has been pretty much suppressed. Labor union movement was severely repressed, right? And so I think from that end too, there are, you know, women workers activism as well. So I don't see there is like one voice that is talking about the food security issues. There are multiple, I think, fronts that are I think trying to tackle the food security issue.
Mm-hmm. Tell me anything. Before you go, What did we miss in this conversation? You know, what did we leave out, or some things that you've been thinking about recently that maybe you would like to add?
Well, I've talked a lot about, I guess, Indonesia, and then one thing I wanted to emphasize is that this is not only about Indonesia, but, you know, there are other trends, and that the push for fortified products as the solution to hidden hunger. And how the sort of market can solve this problem. I think there was a recent article talking about India's case and how Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and GlaxoSmithKline are coming up with different kinds of fortified products, and they package it in a very small quantity so that the pricing is pretty cheap. And their target is the rural impoverished areas. right? And oftentimes they work with local and nonprofits that then do nutrition education, and these organizations are oftentimes funded by international organizations like UNICEF, United Nations Children's Fund. And so, you know, you see the similar kind of dynamics in other parts of the world. And like the dynamic that I talk about in the case of Indonesia, if this kind of nutritional fixes then obfuscates the larger structural issues of that then contribute to food insecurity, right? Like the instability of the global agri-food system, the labor unions in suppression, the lack of healthcare, and the just larger stratification, I think it's highly problematic.
And that sounds very familiar to anyone who lives in the United States, for example. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really the force behind your book. That is one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much. I'm very pleased that you were able to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Aya Kimura is the author of Hidden Hunger: Science, Gender, and the Politics of Smart Food. On our next episode of The Secret Ingredient, Raj Patel, Tom Philpott, and I will talk with the founder and director of Sustainable Agriculture Tanzania, Janet Morrow, about seed saving. You can subscribe to The Secret Ingredient on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and check out our entire archive at thesecretingredient.org. Our engineer is David Alvarez. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy. Thanks for listening.